This is Jim Eakster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Alondra Villarreal is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're joined by Robert Townley Mann, the Manship Professor at LSU and longtime Louisiana Politico. His latest work, and he's written several well-received books. His latest is Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics, and there is much to catch up with Bob about. Here in Baton Rouge Saturday, voters approved a 10-year property tax renewal that funds a majority of our city's bus system, ending months of anxiety about what might happen if it were not approved. And on the statewide level, with an abysmal turnout of just over 13% of the more than 3 million registered voters, three of the four amendments were defeated. The only one to survive was the big one, the one lowering the maximum allowed rate of income tax and allowing the provision for a deduction for federal income taxes. So we will be in a new realm when we file our taxes come 2022. And Bob Mann, first of all, the CATS tax, with businesses already having difficulty hiring employees without a bus system, I can only imagine how that would intensify.
Right. Good morning, Jim. The question was not to pour additional resources into the CATS public transportation system, which I think is really necessary, but just to whether we would have a public transportation system in this parish at all was really on the ballot. And I'm happy to see that close to 60% of the voters, been a low turnout, granted, but 60% of those who voted agreed that we do need at least some form of public transportation in this parish.
Well, the amendment two that I mentioned that did pass, it passed by a fairly substantial margin, 54% to 46%. But the other ones, Amendment 1, which would authorize streamlined election filing, remittance and collections, and use of sales taxes, it failed 52-48. And then Amendment 3, allowing certain levy districts to levy an annual tax for certain purposes, it was killed 58-42. And the fourth one, to increase the amount of allowed reduction to certain dedicated funds when a budget deficit is projected, failed 72-28%. So voters, perhaps to their credit, they picked and chose. They did not vote all for or all against. One of them cleared the hurdles pretty handsomely, but the others were defeated, and one of them was just squashed. What do you make of this? What do you make of this, Bob Mann?
Well, if there was any theme in the three that were rejected, it's that voters don't trust public officials to handle their money, or to decide, decide on the proper amount of taxation, or whatever, however you might want to put it. But it seemed like a distrust in government as it relates to tax revenue or increasing taxes. And the only thing that passed, as you pointed out, was the one that reduces the income tax rate effectively on most taxpayers. By the way, I voted against number two mainly because I thought that it's going to mean that we're going to even rely more on a very regressive sales tax in the state, which is going to make it even harder for people who don't have a lot of income to get by. We need to be doing something about that, and that did not address that at all. The other observation I would make about this is the legislature, none of these would have been on the ballot if legislators hadn't voted to put them there. You've got to wonder about the disconnect between the legislature and the voters right now. I think Jeremy Offord pointed out the other day that half of the constitutional amendments over the last 10 or so years have been rejected by voters. And I think that we need to be having a conversation about whether we need another constitution, because it could just be that voters are tired of being asked every year to approve 4, 5, 6 constitutional amendments.
It is a case in which it appears that amendments, when they're put on the ballot, and it takes 2/3 support in both the House and Senate, voters are skeptical. There is no doubt. And number two did pass, but it is far from perfect, and we'll see how it plays out. And in the past, as we know, Bob, amendments, most prominently the Stelly Plan, passed and then was undone.
Yeah, just a few, and undone very in just a few short years after voters passed it. So a lot of the stuff, I think that voters are just generally suspicious of stuff that comes out of Baton Rouge these days, and in many ways, I can't blame them.
Well, in Baton Rouge, the Katz tax was renewed, and I think the advocates decided to low-key this, because sometimes the more you talk about something, the more the naysayers become engaged, and in this case, it worked, and what a low turnout we had. The vote in Baton Rouge to renew the Katz tax, 12,821 for it, 8,866 against it. And that is a small turnout in the largest parish in the state of Louisiana, 59-41%. It was a huge margin, and last time, as we know, it passed very narrowly. But at least the people involved with the bus system can have a collective sigh of relief, Bob.
Yeah, they can. I think it's still, as I said earlier, it's still a really substandard bus system that I don't think serves people very well in this parish, but at least it's still going to be there for the time being. And now I hope that we can maybe have a conversation here in Baton Rouge about what a public transportation system that serves everyone in this parish might look like, because we deserve, the people of this parish deserve better. And I think you pointed out earlier that it's about our local economy. If workers can't get to work, I was out at a couple of restaurants on Friday night and couldn't get a table because there were many open tables, but because they just didn't have enough servers to take care of the potential customers. And so there's a problem. There's a disconnect there.
In New Orleans, 14 candidates were on the ballot for mayor, and LaToya Cantrell, the much maligned Mayor Cantrell, was reelected overwhelmingly. Once again, a low turnout. She won with 48,750 votes, but that's 65% of those who showed up. And in a 14-person field, Bob, you know, as a political bean counter, that's significant.
Yeah, it was. And I think she was obviously helped by the fact that, I mean, she had a lot of opponents, but she didn't have one major opponent who, there was no coalescing of any opposition around one person. And even if there had been, she was not going to be defeated, but it didn't hurt her that the opposition was as fragmented as it was.
Now, and a listener has already asked about something I intended to ask you about, but I'll go ahead and do it now. LSU is searching for a football coach. One of the purported finalists for the job is the same guy Scott Woodward hired at Texas A&M, Jimbo Fisher, who left Florida State to go to A&M. A&M, by the way, Bob, has an endowment of $13.5 billion. $13.5 billion. LSU, about $500-600 million. And yet we're talking about paying a football coach $12 million a year to leave Texas A&M to come to LSU. Your thoughts, Professor Mann?
Well, I know less than nothing about who should be the next football coach of LSU, so my opinion is worthless in that regard. I just would point out that we toss money around like it's monopoly money when it comes to the football program or any athletic program. We never have trouble finding it, and I know that some of your listeners are going to say, well, that's private money, and that it is, but it's so easy to raise money for what, when we want to pay off a football coach, giving, $17 million out the door. But if you walk across the campus and want to do something good for the students who deserve a better education than maybe what they're getting here, you have trouble raising that money. And it's a real struggle. So it's just more evidence of the misguided priorities in this state.
Well, last Saturday, LSU lost at home. More than 90,000 people did show up to see LSU lose in overtime to Arkansas 16-13. LSU now 4-6 on the season. There will be a new coach, but Coach O is getting $17 million in walking away money. His staff will get another $8.5 million if they are not retained. And last year there was around $10 million spent to revamp Coach O's staff. So there's a lot of money going around for people not to work on the LSU football side, and now there will be much money spent on investing in a new coach and a new staff. Now, Bob, when we look at this situation, the LSU Foundation is updating its efforts to raise $1.5 billion or more for the university, and they're counting money dedicated to football and Tiger Athletic Foundation money in the bean counting process of determining fundraising for the university as a whole. Is that kind of cheating a little bit?
Well, yeah, I think it is. Cheating maybe is a strong word, but I don't think it's. I think your point is well taken. That it's that a lot of that money is going to be dedicated to paying coaches and not paying professors or not scholarships helping students. They might say, well, they're helping student athletes, but I'm not sure Coach O has taught anybody how to read or write over here. But the bottom line is I think we're still the only SEC school that raises more money for athletics and through its foundations than it does for the academic side of the.
All right. 877-217-5757 is your number. We'll return with more from Professor Robert Bob Mann after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Hope you had a great weekend and glad you're spending time with us. Bob Mann is with us, teaches mass communication at LSU, and of course he is an authority on politics and one of the best writers in America today. His books that include his latest, Backrooms and Bayous, Legacy to Power was his first, about Senator Russell Long, and then The Walls of Jericho, Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, Richard Russell, and the Struggle for Civil Rights. A great book about the United States Senate and the Civil Rights measure. That was from 1996. Hard to believe that was 25 years ago that you wrote that book, Bob. But you're an authority on the Senate, and right now in the Senate, we have two Democrats who are holding things up for Joe Biden. The Democrats are from West Virginia and Arizona. West Virginia used to be a reliably Democratic state, one of 10 carried by Michael Stanley Dukakis in 1988. Now every county in West Virginia went for Donald Trump in 2020. And Arizona, which used to be a reliably conservative state, and now has veered blue, or at least purple, it went for Joe Biden in 2020. And Kyrsten Sinema, Senator from Arizona, Joe Manchin, Senator from West Virginia, are being cantankerous and not going along with the plan, at least not yet, not only on the infrastructure, round two, but also on voting rights. What do you make of this situation in which two Democrats are holding up the president's agenda?
Well, I think that over time, whenever Senate control is very narrow, like we've got now, a 50-50 Senate with Vice President Harris potentially breaking ties, or like we had in the early years of the George W. Bush administration when it was another 50-50 split. One or two senators usually emerge to make a lot of difference. I mean, you've got to win everybody. You need every vote. You can't afford to lose a vote. When they've got 55 votes, they can afford to lose a Manchin or a Sinema, and those people are a little less important to building a coalition. But they've got to get 100% they've got to get the whole Democratic caucus to agree on everything they want to do just to do reconciliation. That's not to mention the other stuff they want to do that they can't because of the filibuster. It requires 60 votes. But even when you got close to 60 votes, in 2009, you had senators like Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson of Nebraska, Joe Lieberman from Connecticut, who were holding up the passage of Obamacare because they had objections to it. So even getting to 60 was difficult and amplified the influence of some of those members.
877-217-5757. Please be brief in your comments for Professor Robert Mann. David in Atlanta. David, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. Not long ago, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House of Representatives, threatened phone companies if they cooperate with the January 6th committee. He threatened to take retribution against them. Now the Republicans are threatening to call advisors to President Trump when they get the Congress back to investigate them and possibly file charges against them. This is obstruction of justice, and this is how authoritarian government rules, and the Republican Party is now becoming a party of bullies and thugs.
All right. Your thoughts, Bob Mann, about David's comments.
Yeah, David, it's a very good point, and I think that there's nothing more important that I know of to get to the bottom of than who was responsible and to what degree did the White House participate in the planning or execution of an attempted overthrow of our government about 10 months ago. And, you know, we could debate a lot of particulars about other potential investigations and whether people and members of Congress should obstruct or should have comply with subpoenas. But I just can't imagine anything more important than getting to the bottom of this insurrection on January 6th and that members of the Republican Party almost unanimously, except for two, at least that I know of, in the House, are refusing to cooperate and threatening retaliation for those who are trying to get to the bottom of it. It's just disgraceful and unpatriotic.
Well, that includes most members of the Louisiana delegation.
Well, every Republican member of the delegation in the House, for sure, yes.
And Henry at the Country Club last week made a good point. He says, how many ribbon cuttings will Garrett Graves show up for? Will Steve Scalise, will Clay Higgins and Julia Letlow and Mike Johnson? And they voted against the infrastructure plan. But when those goodies are dispensed, and many of them are in Louisiana, you can bet they'll be standing in line to take credit, John Kennedy and other. What do you think?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about it. I mean, they will definitely show up and take credit for it, and a lot of voters will be none the wiser that they were against it because of the way they will embrace it. But and that's probably not new behavior in politics, taking credit for stuff you voted against. But it's particularly shameful because Louisiana really desperately needs a lot of this stuff, especially when it comes to coastal protection, and they voted against it, and yet they are going to take credit for it. They're certainly going to support the spending of the money, which I think they should. But it doesn't speak well to about them and about their commitment to Louisiana's needs.
Ray in Prairieville. Hi, Ray. You're on Talk Louisiana with Bob Mann.
Thanks for taking the call, Jim. Question. By the way, I like Mr. Mann's outlooks. The thing I'd like to hear about is the resistance to any kind of taxes in the state of Louisiana. When I wrote a protest letter to the editor for the Advocate, they wouldn't even publish it. But on the other hand, Louisiana is rated the 50th worst state in the United States by the U.S. News and World Report. And to get off the bottom of the 50th worst, we have to raise taxes and spend some money on roads and education.
All right. Does Ray have a good point? Or do we need taxes, Bob?
Well, thanks, Ray. And yes, he does. He has a very good point. And I would urge any listeners who agree or want to learn more about this to go to the website of the Louisiana Budget Project and just look at the way that poor people in the state are taxed versus rich people in this state. And that's kind of what I was referring to about the passage of Amendment 2. I think it's going to increase that disparity where poor people are taxed as a percentage of their income almost twice as much as rich people in this state. It's a real problem. And it's not only an inequity and just unfair to poor people and crushing them even more, but it's letting the very wealthy in the state get away without paying their fair share for the goods and services that we all depend upon.
Phil on Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen. The Louisiana legislators are Johnny on the spot when it comes to something that oil company wants, like maybe to be lawsuit proof or not be able to held to clean up their mess. Their shining hour was the bill about putting boxing gloves on fighting cocks. I think that says everything about our legislators that stuff happened before.
All right, well, that was an Elbert Guillory bill. Elbert's been gone a little while, but Elbert probably did that tongue-in-cheek. But nonetheless, when we have these measures, and remember James David Cain had a bill once to reduce the penalty for flag burners, for beating up a flag burner to $25. If somebody's burning a flag, you could pop them for $25. Somebody asked, well, what happens if the flag burner pops one of the victims back? Does the fine apply only to them for $25? But we get down sometimes in some perhaps unfortunate debates at the legislature, Bob.
Yeah, and it goes back to what I said earlier. I just think that I think lawmakers need to question how well in tune they are with the sentiment of their constituents and voters in general to have passed overwhelmingly these constitutional amendments, to put them on the ballot and then to see them, all three of them, go down in flames suggests that there's just a serious disconnect there. And if I were in the legislature and had voted for this, I'd be doing some soul searching this morning, trying to figure out what happened and how we go forward. They just cannot continue to be throwing this stuff on the ballot and expecting voters to approve it just because two-thirds of the legislature voted for it.
877-217-5757 is your number. We have to take a short pause for the news. Alondra Villarreal says Henry at the Country Club is up first when we return, and we will just continue our discussion with Robert Townley Mann, the professor of note at LSU and author of renown. His latest book is Back Rooms and Bayous, and we're back after this time out with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. Bob Mann is in the house, the professor at the Manship School. He's the Manship Chair in Journalism at Louisiana State University. 877-217-5757 is your number. Emails at talk@talklouisiana.org. Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana, you are on with Bob. Hi, Henry.
Well, good morning, Mr. Jim. Good morning, Mr. Bob. Hope y'all doing well this morning. I've got a question dating back to the election we had the other day. Old Henry gets around a little bit and talks to folks, and I was supportive of the renewal of the CATS tax. But I heard from a few people that were slumlords, and they were saying, well, only landowners ought to be able to vote on these property taxes. And they said that the renters don't pay the property tax. Is anybody so blind as to think that those slumlords don't pass the taxes and every other possible expense along to the renters?
All right, Bob, your thoughts about Henry's remarks.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think we long ago settled that question about whether people should own property before they were allowed to vote. But the point to anyone who would say that renters don't pay taxes, don't pay property taxes, is well put there, Henry. Because yes, landlords do pass those costs along to their renters.
877-217-5757 is your number. And a listener asks, Bob, have you switched back to the Democratic Party, or are you still an independent?
Switch back. I'm back in the fold, Jim.
Couldn't keep you away. Well, tomorrow marks the 30th anniversary of the election from hell. David Ernest Duke versus Edwin Washington Edwards. Edwards got 61% of the votes, but Duke got 55% of the white vote, over 671,009 votes to be precise. And you know, some of those people are still voting. They still live here. They don't talk about their vote in 1991 too much, but the David Duke appeal is still resonant in Louisiana, is it not?
Well, it is, but you're right. A lot of people don't want to talk about it. I was working with a producer who did a pretty prominent podcast last year, I guess it was last year, about the Duke election, and I was trying to help him because he had a really hard time finding anyone who would admit to have publicly to have voted for Duke.
You know, that was a good podcast. I didn't hear all of it, but the guy didn't interview Duke. I mean, come on. What kind of a self-respecting journalist doing a story on David Duke does not interview the principal, who would have been available, of course?
And yeah, I guess that's right. I don't know. I don't recall if I ever heard that he had tried and Duke had turned him down, but you're right. Duke is usually pretty eager to talk to people.
He didn't try. And that's a shame, because it was a good podcast.
Yeah.
But David Duke is a part of history. In fact, Tyler Bridges told me he got heat because he got a quote from Duke when Edwin Edwards died. I thought that was appropriate. David Duke is not to be excised from history, even though many of us believe he was a bad part of our history. He was part of it. So how can we ignore that?
No, you're right. We can't ignore. We can't ignore the. I think, in fact, we must not ignore what happened in 1990 and 91 in the state. It really exposed the racism that is still very, very much part of our politics.
And that is what many believe is wrong with America in general, is that we won't even acknowledge the other side. We're picking and choosing when we watch cable television. If we're a Republican, we're probably going to be watching Fox News. If we're a Democrat, we're going to be watching MSNBC if we are a consumer of cable news. Now, my friend John DiGiulio, who's a pretty liberal guy, I'll give him credit. He watches Fox News regularly. He says he does it for humor, Bob.
You know, I respect people who watch all, you know, all this stuff, and God bless him for watching Fox. But I find that my blood pressure is a lot lower if I just don't watch any cable. I just try to avoid it. Sometimes I don't, but for the most part, I don't watch any of it, and I seem to sleep a little better these days.
Okay. Well, I see the Trump Hotel is to be sold for $375 million. Donald Trump's family business has an agreement to sell the Marquis Washington Hotel that was the center of controversy during his presidency, reaching this deal. Even though it's been losing money, it's not been a moneymaker, although, of course, many they stayed there to try to curry favor with the president. And as a person who travels to Washington on occasion, I can tell you the rates there are higher than they are at any other hotel in the city. And he got a lot of government help to turn that old post office, beautiful facility, into a hotel. But Donald Trump appears to have some difficulty in his business dealings, same kind of issues he had in counting beans when it came to the government, with a record $3.1 trillion deficit when he left office. He's gotten problems with his hotel, but somebody's going to pay him $375 million.
Well, it's as you say, it is a prime piece of property just around the corner from the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue in a historic, beautiful old building. So I think it's certainly probably has a good future ahead of it, just with not Trump's name on it.
President Biden last night named Mitch Landrieu, the former mayor of New Orleans, former lieutenant governor of our state, to oversee the $1 trillion in infrastructure spending from the bipartisan legislation that the president is signing into law today. Now, Mitch Landrieu is a guy who many thought would run for president, and he might still. His dad was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development at the end of the Carter administration. What does this mean for the future of Mitch Landrieu?
Well, it's about as high a profile position as you're going to get. That's not a cabinet position in this country right now. I mean, he's going to be traveling all over the country, handing out $1 trillion. You know, that is, if you wanted to run for president, I can't think of a better way to sort of set up your campaign and get your name known to a lot of people who are going to be really grateful for the money you brought in your satchel. So, yeah, I don't know if Mitch still wants to run for president, but this is not a bad way to start.
All right. Got some questions from some emailers that I'll forward to Bob at talk@talklouisiana.org, and still an opportunity to get in at 877-217-5757. Steve Winham, the former budget director who lives in St. Francisville, says that the Stelly plan began as a balanced plan with progressive potential. Once the sales tax cut was eliminated, it became regressive. The Amendment 2 plan is regressive immediately and has the potential to become more so. Do you think the people understood this when they voted Saturday?
No, and boy, Steve is, there are a few people that know more about all this than Steve. He's just so good on this. And no, I don't think people understood. I think people didn't know anything more than, are they telling me my taxes are going to be lower? Yes, I'll vote for it. I don't think most people gave a thought to how this might make our tax system more regressive, but it certainly will.
Now, a listener makes a good point that Duke got a majority of the white vote in his race for U.S. Senate and for governor in 90 and 91, and then Bill Clinton actually carried Louisiana in 92 and 96, and almost by osmosis, that means he would have gotten some of the Duke voters to vote for him. The listener asks, what was the Duke appeal then, and where are those Duke votes going today?
Well, boy, those are such good questions. And, you know, I worked for, as you pointed out earlier, I worked for Bennett Johnston in that race in 1990. And after it was over, we did some polling, post-mortem polling, to try to figure out what happened. And one of the things we learned was that Duke's message really his economic message really resonated with a lot of Democrats, sort of conservative Democrats, who didn't see, who didn't really find the racial appeal as resonant as they did the economic appeal. Just that you've been left behind. You know, I think a lot of Trump's message was Duke's message that resonated. And you know, there were what, 4 million people who voted for Obama in 2016 who voted for Trump 4 years later. The same phenomenon, I think, was at work.
Well, David Duke, in more recent forays in efforts to win offices, has not done well, but he did serve time in federal prison. But at age 71, he's still around. He still makes noise every now and then, but nothing like he did 30 years ago. And to think he was only 41 years old. And I remember the early exit polls after he got in the runoff showed him in front, because the third and fourth place finishers were Buddy Romer and Clyde Holloway. And from a ideological point of view, many feared that those votes might go to Duke rather than Edwards. But you know, Edwards, who died a few months ago, Bob, he never had a doubt. He knew immediately in his heart, in his mind, and he was an astute political analyst of his own, that he was a victor. He he said the only way he could lose to David Duke is if he died.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was, he knew what was going to, I think a lot of people knew that, understood that, that there were going to be enough Republicans who just couldn't stomach David Duke, who would hold their nose and vote for Edwards. I mean, it was the bumper sticker, vote for the crook. It's important.
Yeah. And Edwin Edwards did win going away, but he did so with a heavy African-American turnout. And black voters, as I've stated before, Bob, much maligned in Louisiana, but without black voters, we would have had Governor David Duke and U.S. Senator David Duke.
No question about it. Zero question about that.
And back in the day, in those days, I remember a young guy ran for attorney general in 1991 as a liberal Democrat, a guy named John Kennedy. He ran third that year to Richard Ayoub and Ben Baggert, and John Kennedy, 13 years later, ran as a liberal Democrat against David Vitter and Chris John for the U.S. Senate, the most liberal of the big three in that race. He lost, and then he had an epiphany. And Roy Fletcher, his former political consultant, said, it's because he learned how to read a poll, Bob.
Well, yeah, I mean, Kennedy's clearly a shapeshifter, you know, no moral core there, no real beliefs except what gets me the most votes. And he's, as you say, as Roy said, very accurately learned how to read a poll, and he aligned himself. So, you know, I think every time I watch Kennedy, it's just so clear that it's an act. He doesn't really believe that.
We'll be back with Bob for a few more minutes. Your number is 877-217-5757.
I'm Don Molino on the voice of Louisiana Agriculture Radio Network Studios, powered by Louisiana Propane.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We are now inside 1 year. We're 51 weeks away from the U.S. Senate election next year. It'll be a nationwide vote, but John Kennedy's on the ballot running for another 6-year term. And by the way, as the countdown begins, we're 6 days away from Senator Kennedy's 70th birthday. So hope you have a good week, Senator John Neely Kennedy. But he's running against right now a candidate who's got a nice resume, but very little money and not a whole lot of name recognition. And he's got an uphill battle in a state that's veered right. So does Luke Mixon have a fighting chance, or should we just pretty much concede the election to John Kennedy right now?
Well, I don't think anyone should concede the election to him. As you point out, it is an uphill battle for any Democrat running against a Republican, especially in a congressional or Senate race, because those tend to be more nationalized and less about local issues and more about, you know, control of the Senate and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's going to be tough, but I'm interested to see this guy Mixon's got an interesting background, not totally dissimilar to John Bel Edwards. You know, military, he's a pilot. From a rural part of Louisiana, he potentially has the ability to speak to people in a way that maybe a more urban Democrat, you know, from somebody from Baton Rouge or New Orleans, might not be able to. But we'll see.
We'll see, and we of course are in the march to redistricting as well. Presumably the congressional districts will be redrawn by the time the next election occurs, and the statewide offices as well. But But right now, as we know, the congressional lines are gerrymandered. Richard Baker's old district looks nothing like Garrett Graves' current district, even though they both have the number 6 on them, representing the 6th District of Louisiana. And Richard Baker won over and over back in the day with North Baton Rouge in his district, although he did have one close race against Marjorie McKithen in 1998. Will anything be done to address the fact that North Baton Rouge is in Orleans Parish when it comes to our congressional seats?
Yeah, it should be. It really should be. After the 2010 census, Bill Cassidy gave those precincts to Cedric Richmond, which in turn his district into somewhat of a swing district into the 24th or 25th most conservative district in the country. It is absurd that we have a district that is a gerrymandered district stretching that far, and the goal being to delete minority voting strength in the state. Louisiana really does deserve a second minority majority district, but it's unlikely we'll get one.
877-217-5757 for Bob Mann, historian and author and professor. And Ross Douthat of the New York Times writes yesterday that, but for the electoral landscape of this specific moment in the politics of 2022, the GOP has advantages unlike any in my pundit's lifetime, a chance to win and maybe win big by eschewing the unpleasant work of adaption and simply playing those 1980s hits again. Are the Democrats headed for a bloodbath next year when it comes to the midterm elections?
Well, under the best of circumstances, it's not looking good. The midterm elections for the incumbent president almost never go well for his or her party in the House or Senate. But add to that the kind of voter suppression laws that Republican legislatures have passed around the country are going to make it even harder. Not to mention the additional gerrymandering that's already occurring in these states, which I think the Washington Post said this morning have already added potentially 5 Republican seats to the mix just by the way these districts are drawn.
And Joe Biden is taking it on the chin. And at times he does look weathered, and he is the oldest president on record. He is going to be 78 on November 20th, one day before John Kennedy turns 70. Maybe they can have a joint birthday party, Bob. Actually, 79 years old. He was born in 1942. But I'm looking at the Dow Jones Industrial Average today. It's up 127 points in early trading, 36,227. When Biden took over, it was at 31,000, so that's a 17% gain in less than 10 months. And then the deficit, it went down in the first year. Now, it's still $2.8 trillion, but it's down from $3.1 trillion, about a 10% decline. And yet, if you watch Fox News, you would think the world is falling apart under President Biden. Why is there this disconnect?
Yeah, not to mention that the unemployment rate is below 4% and is heading downward. Inflation is up because of the supply chain problems, and most economic experts think that that's going to resolve itself by early 2022 or mid-2022. So, when the elections occur next fall, some of this may have abated, but Biden clearly needs a few wins, and he's got one. He'll sign one into law today, but that Build Back Better bill would certainly help. But I think as the economy continues to improve, people will begin to look at this a little bit differently. But none of that may matter because of the gerrymandering that Republicans are doing and the built-in advantages they're amassing in this midterm.
All right. Still time to get under the wire with Bob, 877-217-5757, or talk@talklouisiana.org. This one from Hal in Monroe, and David Duke is the gift that keeps on giving. 30 years ago tomorrow will be the anniversary of the race, the election from hell, between him and Edwin Edwards. But Hal in Monroe asks, was Duke a Louisiana phenomenon, or if he had been in some other state, would he have had the same kind of appeal?
Well, no, I don't think he was. And just look at Roy Moore over in Alabama. He is certainly nothing new. He was a continuation of, I think, the racist segregationists that got elected in the South, all over the South for most of the 20th century. So it's No, it's not. I don't think it's anything new at all. I just think we were maybe a little late to the party.
Well, and in the segregation era, when we changed things, Louisiana had problems, but not nearly the problems that some other southern states had. John McKithen is given credit for that, but maybe it's also because of our culture. I don't know, but why did we not have the problems here? And I'm not saying we didn't have problems, but we didn't have the same kind of searing issues that were present in neighboring states.
Yeah, we didn't. And, you know, it could be that there were just, you know, a lot of what we remember in civil rights history is because Martin Luther King and the Southern Leadership Conference went there and targeted those areas. So maybe it's just because the King and his organization didn't think that the ground was as fertile here as it was in places like Birmingham and Montgomery.
Well, and a listener notes that last week I was speaking of Sheriff Jack Strain in St. Tammany Parish, convicted of molesting boys for most of his adult life. And I commented that it's the most affluent, most conservative parish, most educated parish in the state of Louisiana, St. Tammany, that five times elected this evil man sheriff. And yet the same listener notes that for four terms, the citizens of Baton Rouge elected one John R. Rarick as their congressman. And that was in our lifetime, Bob. And John R. Rarick, who was a World War II hero, a prisoner of war, but when it came to matters of race, he was way out of line with the mainstream of America. May have been in line with the citizens of Baton Rouge, but that's unfortunate that he got elected four times.
It was. He was cartoonish in his racism, and he's an ugly part of our state's history for sure.
And lived in St. Francisville in his final days, and I'll say this, he would come on the air with me regularly. He did not shy away from microphones, Bob, but he was a judge too, and not a stupid person, but his views were unbelievably out of sync with the American dream, and yet he served our country in war and had some positive things. But people are complex people, and in Louisiana, at least today, we don't have anybody like John Rarick in our delegation. People talk about Clay Higgins being a buffoon, and I'm not sure he is. I really don't think he's a dumb guy, but he's no John Rarick, Bob.
No, but I think people like Higgins have become a little bit more sophisticated in the way they talk about these issues. They're using dog whistles, but the dogs are still hearing the same signal.
That's a pretty good line from Bob Mann. Well, where are we going as a state and as a nation? Are we going to continue to be bogged down by race, or are we going to get past this?
Jim, I can't prove it, but I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, because the incentives for Republicans to make it worse are all there. And so, I think we're in for a rough ride for the next 5 to 10 years in this country.
And we could have a return of Donald Trump?
No question about it. I mean, the way that the Republicans in these states are gerrymandering and rigging the election systems in their state is designed to reelect Donald Trump.
And a listener notes, this is obviously a fellow who follows politics pretty adroitly, Tracy at the Capitol, saying if the Democrats were to just get hammered next year in the midterm elections, sometimes that bodes well for a Democratic comeback in 2024. He's noting Clinton and in 94 got hammered and then won re-election in 96. You just never know, Bob.
Absolutely. And it does make it, it would make it the election a little more of a referendum on the Republican side in 2024. So I think that's not a bad point.
Thank you, Bob Mann. Another question, though, we'll slide it in. Should Breyer get off the court right now? This is from Holly in the Garden District. Stephen Breyer.
Absolutely. No question about it.
Thank you, Bob. Keep going.
No question about it. Thank you, Jim.
Always a pleasure. And the book is Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Until tomorrow, for Alondra Villarreal, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.